It's a Matter of Trust Funds, the Responsible Person Penalty. This is the Tax Update Podcast for February 23rd, 2009. The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners expect to do their own research confirmed by being raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio files. Such prohibited use include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services located on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Visit them on the web at www.lineberg-services.com. This week, we're going to deal with a case that came down from the Tenth Circuit. When organizations face financial difficulties, the issue of paying the bills can become a serious problem, especially when vendors are beginning to demand payment in order to continue to provide products and services required for the organization to stay in business. In such cases, there's a real incentive to pay the squeaky wheel entities first and delay paying those entities that aren't threatening actions that could close the doors tomorrow. For controllers and others in the accounting department, it's clear that a failure to make a payment to a vendor whose products and services can't be replaced could very well mean the immediate closing and cessation of business and the loss of their own current employment. And if general economic conditions are poor, making the chances of finding new employment also poor, which might describe the current condition in most parts of the country, it's easy to see a number of not-so-nice personal consequences that should occur if the shutdown takes place and we don't pay those people pounding on the doors. However, one of the creditors who is likely not pounding on the door immediately to be paid is the IRS looking at unpaid payroll taxes. However, for payroll taxes withheld from payroll checks, the IRS has a weapon that the other creditors don't have to wield against those who are involved in making the decisions as to which bills get paid. And that's the responsible person's penalty under Section 6672 of the Internal Revenue Code. This week, we're going to look at a case for an individual who lost his case both at the district court level in front of a jury and on appeal to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals on this very matter. We're going to look at the case of Richard A. Smith versus United States on appeal from the United States District Court of Utah. Mr. Smith returned to his former employer to try and help them solve their financial difficulties early in this decade, but ended up being unsuccessful in managing the organization out of its problems and ended up in the end with a trust fund penalty to show for his troubles. Let's take a look first at the basic trust fund penalty provision. And we're primarily concerned with a rather simple snippet of text from the Internal Revenue Code that causes certain tax liabilities to attach to individuals other than the entity that's specifically required to pay the taxes. This is Section 6672A of the Code, and it provides that any person required to collect, truthfully account for, and pay over any tax imposed by this title who willfully fails to collect such tax or truthfully account for and pay over such tax, or willfully attempts in any manner to evade or defeat any such tax or the payment thereof, shall, in addition to the other penalties provided by law, be liable to a penalty equal to the total amount of tax evaded or not collected or not accounted for and paid over. Now, the above applies most often to taxes required to be withheld from payroll for payroll checks to the employees. That is normally the employer's portion of the FICA and the federal income taxes withheld, or what we refer to as the trust fund taxes. This trust fund penalty exists separate and apart from the entity's liability to pay the taxes itself. As long as the taxes remain unpaid, the potential exposure to the penalty remains in place. The regulation, and it's really just one under this section, doesn't go much beyond what is noted in the code itself, essentially repeating the basic outline that we had above and essentially giving us no real extra guidance. But it's important to parse that paragraph there to be subject to the provision. Note, we have to be required to collect, account for, and pay over the tax, and we have to willfully fail to collect or truthfully account for and pay over. The usual issue we run into on the trust fund penalty in a case of a company that's facing financial difficulty is the question of whether we truthfully accounted for and paid over. We may have accounted for, but the question is, did we pay over? Other key issue is whether we willfully did so. and willfully comes into play about whether we had the power to enable the tax to be paid and failed to exercise that power. Now, a person who is held responsible to this provision is referred to as a responsible person when you read the case law. And the test for who is that person is a key question today. And we shouldn't say person. Maybe we should say persons, because you can have more than one in a single case. And note that nothing in the above code section or regulation indicates that the person who's subject to this penalty has to have some sort of equity interest in the entity in question. Rather, the person only must be required to collect, account for, and pay over the tax and willfully fail to do so. And as it should be clear, those are the type of responsibilities that often fall on the corporate accountant and controller. And in most small organizations, it's not an accounting department. It's a single person who's playing controller and the entire accounting department. Let's take a look at our case today. Woodruff Printing, Inc. was a family-owned company that was wholly owned by members of the Woodruff family. It was first incorporated in 1959, and it continued operations until it eventually failed in 2003 and shut down operations. Richard Smith gets involved in this story, though he's not a member of the Woodruff family and never had an ownership interest in Woodruff Printing, Inc. Rather, he'd been the general manager of the firm throughout the 1990s, leaving in 2000. However, after Mr. Smith left, it appears the entity ran into difficulties that they felt maybe Mr. Smith could help them get out of. And after those 2 years were over, in January of 2002, he was asked to come back and deal with the company. Now, the Tenth Circuit goes on to tell us how this story went, telling us that Mark Woodruff wanted Smith to return as accounting manager, but Smith insisted he could only help Woodruff Printing if he were the general manager and put in charge of overall operations. Mark Woodruff understood that upon Smith's return, all of Woodruff Printing's departments would report to Smith, and Smith would be making most of the decisions in the operation areas. After Smith's return to Woodruff Printing in 2002, Smith was also Woodruff Printing's primary contact with the IRS for a system Smith used to pay payroll taxes or employment taxes electronically. Smith was aware from reviewing Woodruff Printing's records prior to his return that Woodruff Printing's financial situation was bleak. So Mr. Smith stepped back into a troubled company, and it appeared that the Woodruff family had hopes that he would be able to bring it back to profitability based on his prior experience with the company. In June of 2002, Mr. Smith sent a memorandum to Mark Woodruff indicating that he projected positive net income for Woodruff Printing for 2002. However, this potentially rosy outlook didn't stay around very long after that memo. Very shortly thereafter, there was evidence that the projections were somewhat optimistic. The court goes on to note that by July or August of that year, many of the suppliers began demanding payment on delivery. That's usually a pretty good indication the company's not paying their bills on time. As a result, Mark Woodruff developed priorities that favored making payments to two of Woodruff Printing's bank lenders, to Woodruff Printing's landlords, and to certain of the material suppliers. But it turns out that the bank, the landlord, and the material suppliers weren't the only ones having difficulty getting paid on time. The opinion continues. In August of 2002, an employee of Woodruff Printing's accounting department sent an email to Smith and Mark Woodruff in which she detailed Woodruff Printing's unpaid tax liabilities, including sales taxes, state taxes, and federal employment taxes. According to the email, there were then unpaid employment taxes for June and July in a total amount of $33,305.22. Despite this unpaid amount for those two prior months, no payments were made to the IRS during August of 2002. Now, not only were taxes unpaid, but after this email, it's pretty clear that everybody, Mr. Smith and Mr. Woodruff, were on notice that there were unpaid payroll tax liabilities outstanding. As well, even though today's case deals with unpaid federal payroll taxes and the trust fund penalty provision in Internal Revenue Code, it should be important to note that many states have similar provisions with regard to unpaid state payroll taxes withheld and sales taxes. Arizona CPAs in particular should be aware of issues that arise with the transaction privilege tax and the potential liability for corporate officers under the Action Marine decision. Again, that's outside the scope of today's discussion, but just realize that entities that run into problems and aren't paying over taxes being withheld, the trust fund taxes may not be your only problem tax. The initial steps that Mark Woodruff, remember he was a member of the Woodruff family and one of the equity holders in the company, took in response to this tax shortfall was to essentially leave the matter to be solved by the accounting department. The opinion notes that after he received the email, he held a meeting with the accounting department employee and Mr. Smith. And he testified at court that he came away from that meeting with the understanding the accounting department would continue to work on the tax problem. So that seems kind of, we met, we decided there is a problem, we're going to, quote, work on it, whatever that may mean. However, Mark discovered later that their working on the problem wasn't solving the problem. Later in the fall of 2002, the court noted, he found delinquency notices from the IRS in the accounting department. Apparently he walked in, came in the department, and discovered, aha, we were still getting delinquency notices about blown payroll taxes. In late October of 2002, the court notes, he sent an email to Smith asking Smith to prepare and provide a schedule of payments to be made for the next 2 months for all Woodruff Printing's accounts payable. In that email, Mark Woodruff pointed out that Woodruff Printing had paid tax penalties for being late on taxes, and that taxes should always be kept current. That latter point is going to become very important in this case because now, since you recall, a responsible person today is not necessarily on Mark Woodruff, but rather on Richard Smith, the non-owner. He's the person involved in today's case. And he was instructed in this email that all taxes be kept current. We're going to discuss when following orders and why following orders is not the perfect defense to the trust fund penalty, which it's not and rarely is. But it's clear that when you're told to pay the taxes and you don't, that's probably significantly worse for you when you get to court. Now, things continued and Mark Woodruff continued to take action on this matter, now telling all the other equity holders about the nature of this little problem. The court notes that at some point near the end of 2002, Mark informed the other family members about this little problem with the taxes, with the printing. It was determined that Mark would monitor Woodruff's payments to creditors more closely, and it was agreed that Smith should limit his check writing to amounts that were less than $5,000. However, I should say, looking back at the way the facts are going to come out here, you'll notice that said should limit. Apparently should didn't mean we're going to. It just might have been a nice idea, but as a nice idea, it never seemed to quite get totally implemented. The court noted that Mark Woodruff testified that he never limited Smith's support authority to pay employment taxes via electronic transfers. And the government introduced evidence at trial that Smith continued to write checks to the creditors in amounts larger than $5,000. So despite the theory that we held a meeting and basically handcuffed Smith and told him, sorry, from here on out, anything more than $5,000, you're not going to be allowed to write the check for. We didn't stop him from paying payroll taxes in whatever amount they may be because we had the electronic filing option still open. And we didn't actually stop him from writing checks in excess of $5,000. That continued to happen. The issue of what Mark Woodruff told Smith to do and what actions he took to enforce those actions becomes central. So the court's summary of facts become important. They first summarize what Mark Woodruff said happened. And the court noted that Mark's testimony was inconsistent at best, is a term they use. That he testified that during 2002 and 2003, the standard operating procedure was for Smith to discuss with him the cash flow problems and the priorities for determining what should be paid. He later testified in 2002, he and Smith discussed how to handle the taxes and that his strategy was then to keep the presses rolling. Remember, we were told before to keep the taxes paid, now we're told to keep the presses rolling, a little different change of strategy. He also testified that in 2003, he made the final decision as to which creditors should be paid, and he was the one who decided to pay or not pay taxes in 2003. In sum, his testimony at trial, the court noted, alternated between stating that he and Smith discussed which bills to pay and stated that he decided which bills to pay. Obviously, an inconsistent story is not very helpful here for Mr. Smith from Mr. Woodruff. The court goes on to note Richard Smith's position at trial, which was that he had no authority to pay taxes. And the court took a look at that assertion in the paragraph that they wrote next. And there they noted that it was undisputed that Smith was aware of, through the latter part of 2002 and all of 2003 until Woodruff Printing ceased operations, that the payroll taxes weren't being paid. At one point, Smith advised Mark Woodruff not to pay bank loans and to pay the IRS. But Smith testified he did not pay the payroll taxes because in July 2002, Mark Woodruff told Smith to defer paying the payroll taxes in order to keep the business operating by paying suppliers. So Mr. Smith put his foot down and said, "We can't pay anybody, we've got to pay payroll taxes," then immediately appears to have withdrawn his foot when told by the owners, by one of the equity holders, to keep the presses rolling. During the period in question, the court noted there were insufficient funds available to pay all creditors and also pay taxes. Smith testified, the court notes, that he reported to Mark Woodruff, got payment priorities from Mark Woodruff, and did not have the authority to override Mark Woodruff. The firm's bookkeeper also was brought in to testify during the district court trial, and on her views of the responsibilities of the various parties that were above her, Mr. Woodruff and Mr. Smith. The court noted that the bookkeeper testified in support of Smith. She stated that during 2002, Mark Woodruff's creditor payment priorities were first to pay two bank loans and then to pay vendors. She also testified that Mark Woodruff had the final decision-making authority of Woodruff Printings, and that in meetings during 2002, Woodruff had the final say as to which creditors would be paid. She further testified that in August 2002, she had a discussion with Smith about how much was owed to the IRS for payroll taxes, and she testified that she discussed the tax program with Mark Woodruff three or four times in 2002. Finally, she testified that Rex and Mark Woodruff had the ultimate authority over the management and finances of Woodruff Printing. Also offered as evidence that Mark Woodruff was running the show was his decision not to sell the firm to a former employee in early 2003. The court noted that Drew Elkins, a former employee of Woodruff Printing, offered to purchase Woodruff Printing in March 2003, but the offer was rejected by Rex and Mark Woodruff. Elkins testified that Smith handled most operational problems, but that Mark Woodruff had the final word as the owner of Woodruff Printing. Elkins also testified that on a couple of occasions, Smith had generated checks for a tax deal and given them to Mark Woodruff to sign, but that Mark Woodruff refused. Elkins testified, however, they did not know that employment taxes were set up by Woodruff Printing to be paid electronically throughout 2002 and 2003. Eventually, the end did come for Woodruff Printing, and Richard Smith found himself faced with a bill for the trust fund taxes from the IRS. The court summarized the end of this saga as follows. The IRS made assessments against Smith pursuant to 26 United States Code, Title 26 United States Code, Section 6672, after making determinations that Smith was a person responsible for withholding, accounting for, and paying taxes withheld from the wages of the employees of Woodruff Printing for the last two quarters of 2002 and the first three quarters of 2003 who willfully failed to do so. The total assessments made against Smith were $279,353. Smith paid a portion of the assessment and then filed suit seeking a refund and, of course, a United States counterclaim for amounts still owed. And with that, we end the saga of Woodruff Printing operating there and in the IRS side. Now we have to go back to the court case that ensued. Richard Smith, of course, wasn't terribly happy about being called to task by the IRS about this little item since, from his perspective, he'd returned to the company as a white knight to try and restore profitability. He had no ownership interest in the entity, and he certainly got indications from the equity holders' representatives that he needed to do what was needed to keep the doors open. And, according to testimony, when he had suggested paying the payroll taxes, they said no. Now he was out of work, and to add insult to injury, the government wanted him to pay over the payroll taxes for the company out of his own funds. However, Richard wasn't totally blameless in this situation. And the mere fact he may not have been the most responsible person isn't going to mean that he won't be held to be a responsible person if it turns out that he's the one that the IRS chooses to go after for this penalty, perhaps because he's the only solvent person left standing. His problem in this case is, despite everything else, there are also indicators that showed that he had responsibility. Some of the bad factors you may recall from our case up front were that he insisted upon having absolute control to return to the company. He also, while he put his foot down and said, "We have to not pay the loans and pay the taxes," he backed off that and continued to work there. He may have presented checks to be signed for the payroll taxes, but when met with little resistance, he went ahead and prepared other checks and got things paid. And unfortunately for him, he also continued to sign checks and release things in the background, and he retained the right to make the electronic funds payments, but failed to transmit the funds over. The Tenth Circuit, in giving its opinion, outlined the broad definition of a responsible person that's been used by the court, and it cited from its own opinion in the 1993 case of Denbo versus United States. The Tenth Circuit said, courts have generally given a broad interpretation to the term responsible person under Section 6672. A person is responsible within the meaning of the statute if that person is required to collect, truthfully account for, or pay over any taxes withheld from the wages of a company's employees. The responsible person generally is, but need not be, a managing officer or employee, and there may be more than one responsible person. Indicia of responsibility include the holding of corporate office, control over financial affairs, the authority to disperse corporate funds, stock ownership, and the ability to hire and fire employees. Among other things, therefore, a corporate officer or employee is responsible if he or she has significant, though not necessarily exclusive, authority in the general management and physical decision-making of the corporation. The court then looked at Smith's overall situation and found that he possessed sufficient authority to be placed at risk for the penalty. They note that the evidence at trial showed he was the general manager during 2002 and 2003. Everybody agrees for that. He came back to Woodrow Printing in 2002 insisting that he be placed in charge of overall operations, to use his term. Smith had the responsibility to oversee the finance and accounting functions at Woodrow Printing during that 2002-2003 period. During 2002, he had the independent authority to draw checks on Woodrow Printing's bank accounts. And the court notes, although there was testimony that Smith's check-writing authority was limited in 2003 to $5,000, the IRS introduced evidence at trial that he wrote a substantial number of checks in 2003 for amounts larger than $5,000. There was also testimony that Mark Woodruff never limited Smith's authority to electronically pay the payroll taxes. The key problem is that while Smith was getting at least some signals from Woodruff that he should keep the presses running, he still retained the apparent ability to get the taxes paid, and had actually paid creditors during that period when he knew taxes were outstanding, apparently on his authority to pay the creditors, amounts that were in excess of the $5,000 that, in theory, he wasn't allowed to pay anything in excess of. So apparently, he was able to make payments that he decided to let go through. Now, I suspect, to be honest, unfortunately, in a small operation, it may very well be that what he was letting go through were things he knew that Mr. Woodruff were not going to object being paid. But the problem was that it went counter to this whole issue that over 5,000 had to have approval. And because he was issuing it himself, that gave him into problems because he was allowing and deciding to pay expenses when in fact he knew the taxes were outstanding. And unfortunately, that electronic filing provision he still held, he apparently had the ability to get those taxes paid. The court notes that Smith argued that he was simply doing what he was told by Mark Woodruff and that he had no power over creditor priority at Woodruff Printing. However, the court notes it's clear, one, that Smith was aware during the quarters at issue that the payroll taxes weren't being paid, two, that he paid other creditors rather than paying the payroll taxes. In addition, although Mark Woodruff and Smith had regular meetings discussing creditor priorities, Mark Woodruff also testified he did not limit Smith's authority to make electronic funds transfers for the payroll taxes at any time during 2002 or 2003. And he sent that email that we talked about earlier in October of 2002 stating that taxes should always be kept current. As I've noted before, being less responsible doesn't solve the victim's problem here. The court specifically outlines that the fact that Mark Woodruff had more control over creditor payment than Smith is not determinative. Significant control is all that is required. That became a major problem for Mr. Smith. The court then goes on to quote a couple of other cases that indicate when that would occur. It quotes from Denbo that in that case it was clear that Allred exercised greater control of the corporation than Denbo, that the Section 6672 does not confine liability for unpaid taxes only to a single officer with the greatest or closest control or authority over corporate affairs. In that case, quoting again from its decision in Denbo, it sufficed that Denbo had significant as opposed to absolute control over the corporation's finances. The court also quoted from the Taylor case. If an individual possesses sufficient indicia of responsibility, he is a responsible person under Section 6672, regardless whether he, one, has the final say as to which creditor should be paid, or two, has a specific job within the corporate structure to see that taxes are paid over to the government. The crucial inquiry is whether the person had the effective power to pay the taxes. That is, whether he had the actual authority or ability, in view of his status within the corporation, to pay the taxes owed. Liability under Section 6672 extends to all responsible corporate officers or employees, not just to the most responsible individual. The court went on to consider Smith's complaint that the court that previous cases had applied exceptions he should qualify for. He claimed to be like the taxpayer in a First Circuit case of Vinnick v. United States, where it found the less responsible person in that case wasn't a responsible person. The Tenth Circuit summarized the First Circuit's holdings in Vinnick as follows. It said that in Vinnick, the First Circuit stated the central question determining whether a taxpayer is a responsible person is whether the taxpayer had the power to pay the taxes during the quarters in question. The First Circuit found, one, that the taxpayer had not exercised any decision-making authority over which creditors were paid, two, that another individual was in charge of the day-to-day operations, three, that merely because the taxpayer had the title of corporate treasurer because the substance of his work involved no authority over finances, the titular authority was not heavily relevant, and four, that the taxpayer having check signing authority was only relevant if the taxpayer was in a position to exercise the authority. That is, did the taxpayer actually have access to the checkbook in order to sign a check? The First Circuit, the court noted, repeatedly noted in Vinnick that the central question was whether the taxpayer had routine involvement in day-to-day management such that the taxpayer had control over daily operations. The Vinnick court concluded, absent of finding the taxpayer possessed actual, exercised authority over the corporation's financial matters, including the duty and power to determine which creditors to pay, as a matter of law, he cannot be a responsible person. Unfortunately for Richard Smith, the Tenth Circuit found it could fairly easily distinguish his situation from that of the taxpayer in Vinnick. The court noted that, contrary to Smith's assertion, they did not feel this case supports his argument that he's not a responsible person. It noted that, unlike the taxpayer in Vinnick, he did have day-to-day involvement in the operation of Woodruff Printing. He was a general manager throughout 2002 and 2003, and remember, a general manager who insisted on having control. He routinely met with Mark Woodruff about the payroll tax liability. The court noted it is true there is conflicting testimony about how much power Smith had over creditor priority. However, the standard is whether Smith had the effective power to pay the taxes. That is, whether he had the actual authority or ability in view of his status within the corporation to pay the taxes owed. The court notes it is undisputed that Smith's authority to make electronic payments of payroll taxes was never limited, and Mark Woodruff directed Smith at one point to keep the taxes current. To be a responsible person, Smith need not have had exclusive control over the payments made to the accounts payable of Woodruff Printing. Smith also objected to the jury instructions. Remember, he actually took this to a jury trial and the jury came in against him. So he had a couple of cases brought up that he objected to parts of the instructions to the jury, and that brings in a couple of other cases that dealt with responsible person issues. First case was the case of Jay versus United States, a Tenth Circuit opinion from 1989. In determining the district court's jury instructions were not in error by not properly considering the impacts of the orders of a superior, the court had to review its initial Jay decision. The Tenth Circuit notes that Smith contends that Jay downplayed the materiality of check-writing authority when that check-writing authority was subject to a superior's restrictions. Jay involved a taxpayer who worked as a bookkeeper for a company that did not pay its withholding taxes. The taxpayer, Jay, was aware of the policy decisions by the corporate's executives, signed corporate checks, and paid bills to creditors from the corporation's bank account, which included funds withheld from employees' wages. But Jay acted according to the instructions from his boss as to which major bills to pay. Helmut testified that he decided whether to prefer other creditors to the United States. The district court notes that it did not decide that Jay was not a responsible person, just that question of whether his actions were sufficient to make him one was a question the jury should have decided, and that the district court's granting of summary judgment finding Jay was a responsible person was an error. In this particular case for Mr. Smith, the case went to trial and the issue was decided by the jury. And the court felt that the overall instructions indicated and gave adequate instructions to the jurors about considering the totality of the situation. Smith also looked to the ruling in Finley v. United States for reasonable cause for failure to pay, justifying that the jury had not been properly instructed on that point. But again, the court found that Smith's case was distinguishable. It explained, in Finley v. United States, and this was a 1997 Tenth Court case, we recognize a reasonable cause exception to excuse the failure to pay payroll taxes held in trust for the government. We further held the reasonable cause exception to 6672 liability should be narrowly construed. We then concluded that the reasonable cause sufficient to excuse a responsible person's failure to pay withholding taxes should be limited to those circumstances where, one, the taxpayers made a reasonable efforts to protect the trust funds, and two, those efforts have been frustrated by circumstances outside the taxpayer's control. In Finley, we remanded the case for a new trial to provide the taxpayer an opportunity to present his defense. The facts in Finley differed from those presented here, the court notes. Under the facts in Finley, the taxpayer directed that the payroll taxes be paid, and by the time he found out his instruction had not been followed, there was no longer any money left to pay them. Here, Smith knew the payroll taxes were overdue, knew that other creditors were being paid instead of payroll taxes, and never took any direct action to pay the taxes. He discussed the payroll tax issue repeatedly with Mark Woodruff throughout 2002 to 2003, but he never actually attempted to pay the taxes. According to the evidence presented, he was even directly instructed in one instance to keep the taxes current. The reasonable cause exception to the liability does not fit the facts of this case, at least not in the view of the Tenth Circuit. So Richard Smith, even though he returned to a company already in trouble and eventually ended up with apparently nothing, apparently not clearly defined instructions, I should say, and oversight from the owners, and instructions from the owners that seem contradictory, both keep taxes current and keep the presses running are given to him as instructions at various points, was liable for the taxes paid. A result the Tenth Circuit notes may appear harsh, and I'm sure Mr. Smith would have a different word for the result. The court notes, although it is a closed case, considering the fact that some of the traditional indicia of withhold responsibility are missing, Smith was not a stockholder in Woodruff Printing, and it was a disputed fact whether he had the authority to hire or fire. The indicia are merely factors to be considered amongst the totality of the circumstances. In Denbo, we emphasize that courts, including our courts, have generally given a broad interpretation to the term responsible person for purposes of 6672 liability. And Denbo states that the responsible person generally satisfies the listed indicia, but need not in every case. Given our scope of review, we cannot conclude the district court erred in denying Smith's motion for judgment as a matter of law. When referencing the relevant indicia of a responsible person, we cannot say the jury's verdict was against the great weight of all the evidence. So for that reason, the Tenth Circuit refused to overturn the district court's decision. What are our lessons from this? Well, unfortunately, many controllers for small enterprises and those associated with payroll in any size organizations are starting to face these issues, as many organizations are finding funds aren't available to meet all demands of creditors. As well, the weekly updates on unemployment statistics are a reminder that if an accountant loses this job that he has right now because the company goes under, he or she may be facing a prolonged period of being out of work. That accountant may also find he's out of work if he decides to say, I'm not allowing anything to be paid to payroll taxes are paid, and discovers that the owner tells him, well, you're out of here, I'm hiring this other guy who will do it, or I'm just going to write the check and I'm throwing you out the door. Pressure mounts from above to keep the presses running by paying off those creditors who pose the most immediate threat to close the doors, under the hope that somehow, by the time the other creditors get in a position to shut us down, we're going to be able to find the money to keep running, or perhaps we'll at least be able to find enough money to keep running those creditors who could shut us down every time they threaten to shut us down. Mr. Smith had a number of problems in the actions he took, and I think we need to take a look at some of the factors that really blew it for him. First, one key issue involved in this case is that Mr. Smith needed to realize early on with the problems the company had that when the trust fund penalty reared its head, he was facing a situation where it would be very likely that his job was in trouble and he should have known it from 2002 forward, simply because the company was likely going out, was in big trouble, wasn't able to pay its taxes. So he faced the risk of losing his job, which eventually happened anyway, but potentially being stuck with the trust fund taxes if he didn't try to make sure at least that got paid. Mr. Smith apparently tried to take the steps a couple of times. You know, he wrote the checks to solve the tax issues. And then when the owner said no, he just quietly put those checks away and kept writing the other checks and paying the other creditors. Mr. Smith retained the right to pay creditors. It probably wasn't a smart idea to stay around once he knew there were unpaid payroll taxes and stay in the accounting department when he had come in insisting on full control. But it certainly was doubly dumb, shall we say, at least in retrospect, to keep writing checks in excess of $5,000 under your own signature and stay around after the turndown without requiring that Mr. Woodruff essentially take over all issues related to paying vendors and take over issuance of all checks and remove all check writing and any authority from Mr. Smith at that point. He keeps anything, he sits in a very bad position, and unfortunately that's what happened here. Honestly, he probably should have, when he discovered payroll taxes weren't being paid, as soon as he would indicate we should pay the taxes and was ever told, no, we're not going to, honestly, that's the case when he should have walked out the door or at least told the owners, either we pay the taxes or I'm walking out the door. Had he taken that position, he wouldn't be facing a $200,000+ liability for unpaid taxes. The key issue is that when you allow any obligation to be paid, when you're aware that the tax obligation is outstanding, and you appear to possess the capabilities to get the taxes paid, you are at huge risk for the penalty. Since in many small business organizations, the controller possesses the effective ability to select who gets paid and who doesn't, there's always risk for that person when payroll taxes are not paid. If you're in that position, you become aware that payroll taxes have not been paid for the organization, and you can, by any stretch of the imagination, be deemed to have the ability to ensure those taxes are paid, you need to take immediate action. You're now aware. Your awareness can make it, your awareness now means your next action could be considered willful if it does anything that results in somebody else getting paid. Certainly, you have to insist the taxes be paid immediately, and ensure you take no action that allows any other debt to be paid while those are outstanding. At least if you aren't willing to pay any amount that goes out the door to somebody else over to the IRS. Those up the line, often the owners of the enterprise, need to be made aware of the unique nature of this obligation and the fact that by asking you to consent to paying other vendors, they are effectively stating that they are asking you for a personal guarantee on the debt to the IRS, a guarantee you're probably not really willing to give. As well, you need to inform them that their ordering of you to do this also likely exposes them to the trust fund penalty for the same reason. And if it becomes clear that any vendor will be paid prior to taxes getting paid, it's time to seriously consider resigning your position, as difficult as that may be in an economic climate when it's not clear where your next paycheck will come from if you leave this job. But if you do that, you'll be just unemployed. If you don't do that and now stay on after things are being paid while trust fund taxes remain unpaid, in the near future, it's extremely likely to end up like Mr. Smith, unemployed and facing an assessment for the entire balance of the unpaid payroll taxes. One unfortunate fact of life is that entities that stop paying their payroll taxes have a really high number percentage that end up going out of business anyway. So the question is not whether you're going to be employed or unemployed. The question simply becomes, are you going to be unemployed with a huge liability hanging over you or unemployed without that liability hanging over you? Those in public accounting also need to be aware of these issues. First, while it's not the usual situation, it is certainly possible to imagine cases where a public accountant could become a responsible person for a client, especially as rent-a-controller type services came into vogue over the last decade. If you have the authority to get the taxes paid, you need to be aware and make sure they're paid. If you're doing rent-a-controller services, you need to make a condition of staying in that position that all payroll taxes must be paid currently. And if you become aware they haven't been, until they're fixed, you're leaving, you can resign the engagement instantly. Secondly, you need to counsel clients about this issue. Sometimes their own accounting department, simply not wanting to give anybody bad news, may cover up the fact that they're not paying the payroll tax liabilities. And they do that not because they're just not aware of the risk to themselves of doing it, but the bad news is they also put the owners at risk because owners are going to have a tough time explaining why they didn't know. First thing is, that's going to be an uphill fight with the agent to start with. And secondly, many cases, by the time they do know, now it's going to be in a situation where clearly, you know, there's going to be a choice between shutting the doors or paying off the other vendors and then hoping we can fix the payroll tax issue later. Your clients need to understand that as soon as they become aware of the unpaid liability, even if it all happened because their staff, you know, did something that they shouldn't have done, that they should have been telling them what was up, they need to be aware of the exposure to themselves, and there may be some very tough decisions they have to make very quickly, but that in essence, it may all be over but the shouting in terms of the company staying around by the time they discover some of these things, and we need to be aware of that. You also need to be, unfortunately, in a case like that, very, very honest about the company's real ability to continue at that point. In essence, can we do it? But the one thing you cannot do is just ignore the payroll tax problem. This has been the tax update for February the 23rd, 2009. Now, I've been doing a few of these, and I got this one out this week a little bit later than normal. You may notice if you follow it, it usually comes up earlier in the week, and I'm getting it out later this week because I had to do some podcasts for state societies, and I was working on some other things over the weekend, attending the Phoenix Tax Workshop, doing a few other things over the weekend, but we're cleaning this one up, getting the pieces together. I'm still on Twitter. You can follow me there at Ed Zollers if you want to follow me on Twitter. Remember, too, the materials for this podcast are on the website at www.edzollerstaxupdate.com. And it's probably not a bad idea to go look at this because it also has a link to the full decision in the Smith case is available in the materials on the website. As always, the Tax Update podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Be sure to visit them at that location and consider subscribing to their email newsletters. This has been the Tax Update.